Welcome to the Overthinking It Book Club. This is Ender's Game, Part 2, Chapters 7 and 8. I'm Matthew Rather, and here with me is the world's foremost authority on Ender's Game, Ben Adams. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I can't wait to talk about Chapters 7 and 8. So this is what we're doing here. We have the Overthinking It Book Club, where we're going to, week by week, take apart Ender's Game, and this is for the benefit of the people who might be just joining us or who might have just stumbled across this post or this podcast. And there are weekly podcasts available on a schedule that you can see in the first Ender's Game post, and links to all of that are on overthinkingit.com. And there's an iTunes feed also that you can subscribe to, or an RSS feed if you don't use iTunes as a podcatcher, where you can get our week-by-week commentary on the book. And I'm very excited this week that we've also opened the forums for week one and week two. That's chapters 1 through 6 and 7 and 8, so that we can incorporate some of the comments. We can highlight some of the comments in the forums. And all the comments are very good. There's been a very good discussion going on in the Overthinking It forums, which you can reach at overthinkingit.com/forums, or by clicking the forums link in the main menu on any page of Overthinking It. We can't give every comment the attention they deserve, but you can check them out there and enter the fray yourself. Enter the battle room of the Overthinking It forums. Just remember that the enemy's comment is down, though hopefully upvoted. We'll be incorporating the voices of some of the people from the forums. And I also want to highlight that we will start one official forum thread with study questions provided by Ben, who is the world's foremost authority on Ender's Game, and will highlight a lot of the plot, thematic, character, philosophical issues as the book unfolds. You can also start your own comment thread, so you're not restricted, like Ender playing the giant's drink game. You don't have to choose one of the two cups we present to you. You can punch us in the nose and burrow into the eye of the comments section by starting topics yourself. There's one actually this week about another series of books, which I didn't know anything about, but that we can talk about a little bit as the podcast goes on. So Ben, let's start with what happens in this installment, chapters 7 and 8 of Ender's Game.
So as we'll do this primarily for the benefit of people that don't remember exactly which chapters we're dealing with here, or what happens in chapter 7 and 8 specifically. So this is chapter 7, Salamander, and chapter 8, Rat. Which, as their title suggests, is Ender's forays into Salamander and Rat Army, his first experience in an army in the battle room. So he's assigned to Salamander, and so this is where he first meets Petra in Salamander Army and gets his training on maneuvering and sharpshooting, and his first challenges with his kind of power struggles with Bonzo, and how Ender isn't allowed to do anything in Salamander Army, and we get some good stuff there. Then chapter 8, we're looking at Rat Army, and we're introduced to Rose the Nose and Dink Meeker. And we get his first battle where he actually gets to do something, where Rose sends him on what's basically a suicide mission, attacking the other person's gate. And we also get the little aside from Dink about how the teachers are the enemy. And then we end with the older boys attacking Ender's training group, where Ender's training with the Launchies in the battle room, and the older boys attack them, and there's the bloody confrontation there. And that's those two chapters. That's where we're at right now.
There's also, I mean, there's just to highlight one other thing. I think there's a confrontation between Ender and Bonzo that is a little bit interesting. Where it's clear that Ender is very good at managing up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, good. So let's dive in. It seemed to me that the most important thing, kind of at a high level, about this was the different styles of the two commanders of the different armies. Bonzo being authoritarian to the point of being dictatorial and very rigid, but also, I mean, also having not just sort of a very rigid commander, but also having a kind of personality deficit where, you know, he can't tolerate questions, right? He can't tolerate any kind of challenge, or can't be bothered to kind of justify himself at all. And then Rose, who is hands off, who is pretty much the other extreme, who is kind of a slob, and Dink operates his own kind of runs his own shop within, runs his own sort of strike force, right, within the rat army. Is that what you picked up on also?
Definitely. And that's the question I put out in the forums, that there's this, the interesting choice here by both Orson Scott Card as the author and also by the school to put Ender in these armies where we do have these kind of extremes of leadership. And I think it's also important to note that there's also kind of these models of followership in Petra and Dink, that in addition to meeting these two leaders, Ender meets two key soldiers in these armies who have their own skill weaknesses and strengths. And Ender kind of learns from all four of them about how to be both a leader and a follower to some extent.
That's interesting, right? Like, I think that the value of being a good follower is underrated. There was a talk on the internet recently, it was a TED talk or something that got shared on Upworthy or something like this, by Derek Sivers, who created CD Baby, and so made his money in the first internet gold rush and now is a professional blog post author or something like that. As part of the, you know what I mean, as part of the internet millionaire commentariat.
Right.
Not that I'm bitter, because overthinking it just came a couple years late for that, right? But anyway, talks about the value of not only, and he uses a video of people dancing in a music festival. Have you seen this thing, Ben?
Is this the one where somebody just starts dancing and kind of like when nobody else is dancing, one person stands up and then everybody starts dancing around them?
Yes. Yeah. And if you've ever been to a music festival, an outdoor music festival, you know that there's like, you know, there's always a somewhere in view, a hippie dancer, and usually you can safely ignore them. But in this case, this whole like dance party kind of springs up around them. And this video is kind of played of this phenomenon happening as it's analyzed in real time by Derek Sivers in his TED talk or whatever it is. And he talks about the value of the first follower, of the kind of the primary follower, because you're not a leader until you've convinced at least one person to follow you, right? And I think you could do worse. You could do a lot worse than have a Petra or a Dink on your side. And these are people, I mean, it's funny, these are people who are kind of exempted from the hierarchy, right, from the kind of the military hierarchy of some of these armies, because they're so effective. Petra as a marksman and Dink as a toon leader in his own, in his own right, separate from the larger structure of Rose's command. And toon is short for platoon, right?
Yes, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, as far as we know. Okay, so, it's interesting that both of these people have the confidence to do their own thing within the system, with the knowledge that they are so valuable that, you know, nothing bad will befall them for their defiance. That does not seem to me to be the best way to maintain discipline in a chain of command.
Though I think it's quite common. I mean, it's a simple fact that the competent have more leeway than the incompetent.
Sure.
That if you're not very good at your job, you're not going to get a lot of slack when you want to get out of work a little early to go to the dentist, because they have no reason to keep you happy. But if you're really good at your job, well, then you're going to get some slack. And to some extent, even in the U.S. military, this is institutionalized. And I'm thinking here of the Special Operations Forces, which are almost universally composed of extremely fit, extremely motivated, largely intelligent individuals, but they often have relaxed areas of military discipline. So the big one is grooming. Oftentimes you'll see Special Forces guys with big bushy beards and long hair. They also skip a lot of...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I saw Zero Dark Thirty. Yeah.
Exactly. And, of course, part of that is an operational necessity of to blend in some of the parts of the world they're going to. You can't be have a traditional haircut. But part of it is also just a recognition from an institutional standpoint that when you get to a certain point of skill and ability, the normal requirements kind of fall away, that we expect you to do what you're supposed to be doing, so we don't need you necessarily to do all the kind of Mickey Mouse stuff, as it's often referred to.
Well, it's, I mean, it's interesting because that stuff, that Mickey Mouse stuff, is sort of a symbol, right? It's theologically, it's sacramental, right? It's an exterior sign of an inward reality, and it's the inward reality of discipline and motivation and sacrifice and dedication. And once you can really internalize those values, you can let the exterior manifestations of those go, because you will have, your behavior will be the exterior manifestation of those, and you don't need to fake it until you make it, once you have already made it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, most of the traditional things that we'd use as tools of control in the military mindset are a bit of a psychological hack, that by having people march in unison and salute and use all the rank structures and things like that, all of that is a roundabout way of programming so that when the bullets are flying and the enemies are charging at you, you don't break line, because that's what's important.
So this is an interesting, thing about Ender's Game. Usually in these stories, at least the ones that make it into our popular media, which I fully recognize don't probably reflect the actual reality of being in the U.S. military anyway. Usually there's a central figure like Arlie Ermey in Full Metal Jacket, or like in An Officer and a Gentleman, who is it? Lou Gossett Jr., I think, right? Or and on that there is, and there's this mentality of kind of like breaking down and building back up again, breaking down old habits of mind and of life, and building up new habits of, you know, of military life and instilling the discipline, etc. Ender's Game is completely absent a person like this, not exactly a father figure, but what, like a sort of attentive uncle figure, right? a very loudly screaming, and in the case of Officer and a Gentleman, karate kicking uncle. You know,
right,
who's watching out for you and sort of monitoring, keeping tabs on your progress. And we know that Graf is, in the case of Ender, but he's a lot more remote. He's not in his face yelling at him at 6 a.m. or whatever. He's sort of operating abstractly through the design of institutions and through abstract experimental design to mold Ender into a certain form, and that this drill sergeant role from these I should say drill instructor, right, because they're not always sergeants, this role is played by Ender's peers in battle school, who are senior to him, both in the command structure and also in age, but who are fellow students, right? And that's an interesting universe largely without adults in it.
Right, and actually chapter 7 opens with what, at least I think, how Graf would explain why that is, and he says that the children aren't normal. They act like history. Napoleon and Wellington, Caesar and Brutus. So I think it's implied to some extent that because these children are so brilliant, that the only people that can really challenge them are each other. Like, that's the best way to keep them challenged, that a traditional drill sergeant just simply wouldn't be able to keep up with the genius that is these children. So instead we pit them against each other.
Or pit them against a computer program that somehow reads their minds.
Right.
So, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, the talk about giftedness, right? Like the discourse of giftedness is is interesting. There's a certain storytelling bias towards Chosen One stories because it makes hero's journey types of structures possible. And by the way, a lot of this is discussed in the forum post that accompanies week one. But I think there's also here, I mean, even among the exceptional, Ender is exceptional, and he's in an exceptional, you know, sort of environment. Around college, I had a girlfriend who was in the teacher prep program, which was big in my college for some reason. A lot of people wanted to become teachers, or at least to be trained as teachers. And when they studied special education, alongside certain kinds of cognitive deficits or genetic abnormalities and other stuff that can present challenges in institutional education, they studied giftedness as a sort of need for special education, because it's often the case that you know, kids who are gifted in one area may have deficits in other areas, or their giftedness may make them bored and prone to act out, or, you know, just sort of be difficult for a lot of reasons, right? Like, and if I don't know, I sometimes, this is an oversimplification, but I sometimes think that science fiction, the whole genre of science fiction, which I love, is a kind of revenge fantasy for nerdy smart kids where you get to cast yourself as the hero and everything. You know, if only everyone was if only the rules of this world were different, all the nerdy smart kids like me would, you know, we're all little Enders, though. I don't know. I hope not, because that would be disturbing. you know, it raises interesting questions, I think, about the idea of giftedness. Is this something that's occurred to you in your many readings of the novel, the idea of sort of exceptionality or giftedness, as distinct even from like competence, the way we've been discussing in Ender's Game?
Absolutely. And I think it's something that Orson Scott Card, was deliberately aiming at. I think the introduction to the book discusses how he's had, you know, positive responses from gifted teachers and gifted children, and, you know, to the extent to which that's true. But that's kind of the defining aspect of Ender, is that he is gifted among even the gifted, that he is the pinnacle being. And I want to key off what you said about how science fiction is something of, I guess, a Mary Sue fantasy for nerds, that it's a chance for...
I'm not actually putting forth that point of view. It's a lot of things, but sometimes I have the uncharitable thought that is one of the dynamics operating within science fiction.
Right. Well, and of course, it can be that, and it can also be good literature and good entertaining and, you know, do a million other things.
Of course.
But one of the things that I think is interesting about Ender's Game is that Ender is also, while he's small, he's considered small and not particularly strong or anything like that, he is physically powerful, in the sense that he wins all of the physical fights he's in, or at least all the serious physical fights he's in up to this point. He's able to destroy, and he's able as leverage in the physical world. This is something, actually, I'll touch on something that was posted in the forums. Dan Alt compared Ender to the Miles Verkosigan series of novels, which I think you said you're not familiar with, and neither am I. But he says that Miles is similar to Ender in that, but Miles has physical deformities, or is physically very small, and so is Ender. But the difference is that Ender wins most of the time physically, which I think is interesting, and I think somewhat opens up Ender's Game to the criticism that it's a bit of a power fantasy for the really, really smart. Because not only does Ender win in the battle room, where presumably the mind matters more than the body, but he also wins out in the streets because he's just so darn smart.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not... I mean, it, sure, just to play devil's advocate, with respect to the point you're making, he's not in arm wrestling competitions, right? Like,
right.
It is, I mean, it is the case from my, you know, being a nerdy kid, my relatively small experience of fighting out in the street, you know, the, like, tactics do matter a great deal.
Right.
And you know, if he's anything, he's a great tactician. And so using his, you know, using his kind of surroundings and using his even his diminutive size, you know, as a trying to make an asset out of that liability is what wins Ender a lot of his like schoolyard fights, right?
Absolutely, and I'll now undermine the point I just made, because obviously I love Ender's game, so I don't want to tear it down too much. That I think the two things that make sense that what set Ender apart in the two fights we've seen so far, the fight with Stilson in Chapter 1, and then at the end of Chapter 8, the fight with the boys in the battle room, the two things that set Ender apart, the first is that he's able to emotionally manipulate his enemy. He's able to get into their head, kind of, and figure out what words he can use to get them into a disadvantageous position. He manipulates Stilson into telling his kind of goons to step back and fight him one-on-one. And he manipulates the older boys in the battle room into attacking kind of headlong without really taking any time, kind of gets them angry so that they're not very effective, which is certainly something that he's good at. The whole idea is that he's able to manipulate the enemy and get in their position. And then the second, arguably more important, is that he is willing to inflict harm. He is willing to commit violence, which doesn't sound like much, but in the real world is actually a pretty substantial advantage in a fight. Something that military training does a lot of is trying to get people over the natural not inflicting violence on people. You know, when you have your little schoolyard fights, for the most part, you pull your punches. You might be slapping somebody, but you're not really trying to hurt them for the most part. And that's something that the soldier has to overcome, that unwillingness to do violence. I can't remember which of his books, but it's in a Neal Stephenson books where he says that a serial killer with piano wire is more dangerous than a 14-year-old with a bazooka. because the serial killer is willing to use the piano wire. So even though it's not that dangerous of a weapon, he's going to kill a lot of people with it because that's what he does. And he's willing to inflict violence, whereas just some random person with a bazooka is going to put it down and hide it and make sure nobody gets hurt with it.
Right.
And so Ender just kind of naturally has this instinct of, when it's time to inflict violence on another person, he is able to do it instantly. And he kind of has that instinct, and that gives him a much bigger advantage over other boys who generally probably aren't willing or aren't prepared to inflict that level of violence.
Yeah. So this is interesting, but violence, you know, it's funny, like Ender seems to have the proper relation toward violence from a military point of view, right? Like it's never an end in itself, right? Like the process of being violent, you know, or the fact that it involves hurting another kid, like in the case of the buggers, is not ever pleasurable to him the way it is in a sadist like Peter. It's instrumental to a larger goal, which in the case of these fights with larger kids is, you know, survival or not getting, or self-defense. Right. So, he has the kind of the relationship to it, you know, that you'd want a space commander to have, which is that, like, we're not shooting buggers because we like shooting buggers. We're shooting them because we need to take this planet, or we need to, you know, I don't know, rebuff their attack, or we need to, you know, achieve some higher order objective, which is at some sense, at some like higher level, morally justifiable, and you know, and the tactics and the ends to some extent justify the means because there are no other means available, I guess.
Right, and he also, though he's willing to inflict the violence, he has the kind of self introspection, and he feels the moral cost of what he does, which is of course what we want our soldiers and people that inflict violence to do. We're perfectly willing to accept that, yes, sometimes the police will need to shoot a criminal, but we want that to be a maybe not painful experience, but we want that to be felt. by both the state and the individual who's inflicting that violence, in the hopes that it will only be done when it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. Everyone vote for more funding for PTSD treatment at the VA, right? Because, you know, a lot of people are right. feeling the moral cost these days. Let's go into another, comment from the forum. Speaking of being willing to inflict violence, this is the Giants drink scenario. Now, it struck me like, since we recorded our first episode, which we pre-taped a while ago, for chapters 1 through 6, the world, the internet, and the video game community has seen the release of Grand Theft Auto 5, which, you know, allows you to walk around in the open world and do awful things, as have all of the Grand Theft Auto games up to this point. So, honestly, like, poking the giant in the eye, right, like, strikes me as being small potatoes compared to some of the things you can do in the GTA universe.
Right. I mean, after you've seen a 8-year-old play GTA 5 for 5 minutes, it's pretty quaint that in Ender's Game, he's the first person who ever thought of going for, of trying to kill the giant instead of playing the game. Like, no, that's probably plan A for most people when they're playing GTA 5 is, how do I go off mission and blow something up?
Yeah. Or yeah. How many stars can I get before the, you know, before I can no longer keep playing, or, you know, I don't know, some of the more misogynistic and sort of morally terrible things you can do in that game, though economical. this is from Moment Eye in the Moment Eye in the forums. Said, I found the Giants drink scenario unconvincing this time, though. I'm assuming that means this time rereading the book. It's presented as a kind of Kobayashi Maru to illuminate the unwinnable situation, but it's inferior to the Star Trek solution on a couple of points. First, it doesn't have any real stakes or decisions. In the Kobayashi Maru, you have a starship to command and a universe to play in. In the Giants drink, you have a coin toss with a loaded outcome. Kirk goes outside the game and reprograms it. Ender finds a programmed or generated secret move that the game allows. It seems pretty unlikely, though, that the other prodigies at the battle school will not have tried the move attack, especially in a video game where historically most problems are solved using the attack button, right? Like, and that's interesting. Yeah, in the history of like joystick video games, you know, when there used to be a joystick and one button, it was the fire button to fire at the space invaders or asteroids or what have you. That no one would have ever thought to punch the giant in the face, right? Like, that's a, I don't know, that seems like they're getting very, very poor strategists, right? Very, very kind of rigidly rule-following tacticians.
Right. It's assuming that everybody else who plays the game only kind of works on instrumental behavior, that the drink is in front of them, so they have to pick a drink. They're not willing to think at all outside the four corners of the game, which is actually something we'll get into later in the book. I don't want to hit that now, but I have a similar complaint to later events in the book. But I think it is a good metaphor for Ender's willingness to kind of cut the Gordian knot of the problem he's presented with, which comes up again and again and again, that Ender is willing to go to the extreme in order to defeat whatever scenario he's presented with.
Well, that's an interesting, the analogy to the Gordian knot is interesting to me, because the idea that like Alexander cuts the Gordian knot strikes me as a fundamental misreading of the Gordian knot and what it's for, right? Like,
oh, it absolutely does.
But it's not right. Like, it's not a you want to say Alex, buddy, right? Like, it's not a knot for untying. It's a knot for contemplation, right? And it's clear in Star Trek that the Kobayashi Maru is a scenario for contemplation, and it's actually presented as a kind of a character flaw in Kirk to a to a certain extent, one that Savick points out, or that Savick is a foil that allows the writers to point out, that he was unwilling to sort of contemplate in the way that the Kobayashi Maru is meant to make you contemplate. And so Ender's, it doesn't make a ton of sense, right? Like Ender's, we learn in the universe of the book that Fairyland is programmed. So, Fairyland is the reward for winning the giant's drink, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But I think it's in these chapters where they talk about the fact that Fairyland is programmed only as a passing reference, but this computer is like super powerful and can like reprogram itself to accommodate, you know, what happens to the child as it goes through the game.
Yeah, this game is kind of interesting. I mean, there's some sense in which they don't kind of understand the technology that they're using. And it's also supposed to get like, I think it personalizes itself to the individual psychology of the player, right?
It's supposed to be primarily a diagnostic tool. But the whole point, and that's the whole point of the giant's drink, is that it's not so much for the player to contemplate the giant's drink game. It's supposed to be kind of like a warning sign for the battle school to see like suicidal tendency, that your willingness to accept that a situation is hopeless, which is of course normally something that you want in a military commander. You want your military commander to be able to identify when a situation can't be won and withdraw gracefully instead of continuing to attack even when all hope is lost.
Mm-hmm. Or Worf-like, you know, go to ramming speed and shout, "Perhaps today is a good day to die."
Right.
yeah. Good. Anything else from the forums that struck you that you want to bring up?
Well, there's on the Miles Verkosigan thread, Potato Knight talks about how Miles is a force of nature. And I can't really comment on that, again, having read the novel. So I want to comment on to the extent to which Ender is a force of nature. Because he at the same time, in a way, he's a force of nature. Because he's a force of nature because he overcomes any obstacle placed in front of him. Thus far in the book, there's no obstacle that he can't eventually overcome. But traditionally, we associate a force of nature as having either kind of no agency or agency of its own. That if we describe a person as a force of nature, we are typically talking about somebody who is focused on their own goal and single-mindedly pursuing it, kind of knocking down all the obstacles in his way. But Ender is, he knocks down all the obstacles in his way, but it's towards a goal that's been determined for him by someone else.
Sure.
And throughout the course of the book, he's being channeled and kind of manipulated by Graf to get the result that he wants, to get the result that Graf wants.
Mm-hmm.
So Ender has the power of a force of nature, but never quite unleashes it for himself, which I think is an interesting dichotomy for a hero, because normally we do see a hero who is pursuing his own agenda, which isn't really necessarily the case with Ender.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, what is the? But clearly, these things are these kinds of tasks that are programmed for Ender are he's suited to them, right? They are they are egocentric for him. They are in line with his personality. You know, I don't know if he would be a great violinist.
Right. We're given the sense that, because we're told, you know, up front when it's talking about how Peter and Val are every bit as smart as Ender, they just don't have the disposition for this particular task.
Yeah, it's and, right. And it's so like, so what is, I mean, this is like one of those old Greek philosophy things, but like, you know, what is freedom, right? Like the ability to act in accordance with your nature in some formulations, right? Rather than rather than the ability to simply do whatever you would like at any given moment. You know, and Ender is given the ability to act in accordance with his nature. And it's highlighted, I think, especially by the fact that he has such a conflicted relationship kind of with his own nature, and sort of meditates on that towards the end of chapter 8, where it's like, you know, what if the things that they need, or that humanity needs, or that they're trying to encourage in me, what if these parts of myself are parts of myself that I don't like, you know? But there's still, there's still parts of him, right? There's still in his personality somehow. And this is something, I'm not sure if this is really, is he seven by this point? Because he has a birthday during this.
I think so. Yeah. He has his first birthday up in battle school while he's there.
I'm not sure that this level of introspection about one's own personality strikes me as more adolescent, right, than it is really sort of latency childhood level of introspection, like who am I in relationship to the society, why do I have to do the things that I have to do, and you're not the boss of me, Dad. Right, like that it strikes me as a little convenient that he has this level of psychological sophistication with respect to introspection and stuff like that. But he's not, it's not like, I don't know, Ender, humanity needs you to play the violin, or it's not, it's a little neat, but then it's a story, you know, that it's kind of a round peg in a round hole scenario, right?
Right. Though to some extent, because if Ender had his way, he wouldn't be a soldier, because he doesn't particularly, while he's well suited to it, he doesn't enjoy destroying other people. He doesn't like fighting a war.
Mm-hmm.
So if he is a round peg, you know, fitted for a round hole, but maybe, I don't know, maybe he's a square peg in a round peg's body.
he's going to get peg reassignment surgery.
Yes.
Sure. I mean, that's sort of interesting. You get the sense that he would be a computer programmer, right? Like if he were left to his own devices, that he sort of likes tinkering, and he's presented as being good at, you know, computer stuff.
Right. Or any number of things which are more kind of creative or collaborative in nature. You know, he does have leadership skills. So one assumes he would, all, no matter what field he was in, he would rise, because he's supposedly brilliant, but it might not be quite in the same way that he does as a soldier.
Sure.
Or as a more, not as a soldier, I should say, as a commander, because those are two fundamental, getting back to what we're talking about the difference between leadership and followership, there is a fundamental distinction between soldiers and officers.
Right.
And it's not necessarily a better than distinction, it's simply it's a distinction in kind. There are fantastic senior enlisted soldiers that will be the first ones to tell you that they would hate being an officer. And there are fantastic officers that would probably make terrible soldiers, because they would be constantly questioning the people above them, telling them what to do.
Sure. Yeah, right. It strikes me as fundamentally different skill sets. And there's the old saying that you get in any kind of organization, you get promoted to the level of your own incompetence, right?
Like, right. The Peter Principle.
Yeah, the Peter Principle, exactly. And like it's funny, the reward for being good at something is often having that thing you're good at taken away from you, and given a thing that you find less gratifying that you're not as good at. Right. And that involves, like, I don't know, administration and grant applications. And right. You know,
this is the thing that Dink is fighting against.
Yeah.
That he's unwilling to take leadership because he's not comfortable with what it will do to him to take that role.
So that's interesting. That's interesting, right? Like and it's one of two interesting parallels with the Hunger Games, something similar that happens in the Hunger Games that I noticed in this particular section. The other was the kids in the game coming back as wolves, right? Which happens in the It happens in Ender's Game, and the idea is that there were sort of wolves all along, right? Like the other children, the kind of the pure children on the playground are actually like vicious predators, sort of in disguise, right? And it's deployed in the Hunger Games for an extra dose of psychological horror, and it was one of the things left out of the film adaptation of the Hunger Games, probably wisely, because it's one of the more icky things to think about in a book that's full of icky things to think about. But the other is that I don't know if you recall or if you've read the Hunger Games, but when PETA goes into the ring, one of the things he says, or into the arena, one of the things he says is, you know, I don't want them to change me. You know, I don't want them. I don't want to become the thing that the games kind of demand that you turn into. And that's what Dink is saying. It's not that he's badly suited to command, because he is in fact a very good commander of his platoon. He doesn't want an army of his own, because he doesn't want to have that kind of relationship with the teachers, right? So it's the relationship up, not the relationship down. That's the problem for it. You get the sense that he would run a pretty good army, right?
Right. And that's an interesting comparison, because another thing that kind of distinguishes PETA from Cat, which is Dink from Ender, at least in this stage of the book, is that they're both thinking about the political situation, that they're both thinking about how this game that they're a part of is part of a larger political situation. Because PETA recognizes in the Hunger Games that the Hunger Games are a political tool by the Capitol to, you know, oppress the districts. And Dink is convinced that the Battle School is just a political tool being used by, I can't remember exactly what his conspiracy theory is, but I think by the international fleet to keep political power over the individual countries.
Yeah, and because he is Dutch, I think, in the book, right?
Right.
And
which this is showing the political age that the book was written in, is it assumes the Dutch were under the new Warsaw Pact's thumb.
Which is the evil empire of the Soviet Union, right? Like
right.
projected into the future. I mean, it's funny in some ways, the actual history, the way it turned out is a little more insidious. Like, we're not going to have, a communist economy with totalitarian government. We're going to have a capitalist economy with totalitarian government, which actually in some ways is a lot worse. But let's leave that controversial opinion aside. Yeah, okay, so the book is showing its intellectual pedigree, or its kind of like world historical pedigree, as a, you know, as a made object. And I guess in our next installment, we'll get a little bit more into the political situation, on the ground. Right. But does Dink talk here about like there's kind of an impending global civil war, coming?
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the intuitions that he has, or one of the, you know, one of the feelings that he has about the political situation that he's witnessed.
Which is an interesting observation, because it assumes that when, you know, that when two groups come together for some matter of mutual need or mutual convenience, that as soon as that need is gone, so too will the union of those two groups.
Right.
That there's no chance that in the intervening time with the union of the two groups that there'll eventually be enough
tradition
that they won't go along with it, which I'm not 100% sure is really borne out by history, because a lot of larger political units that you can think of, the European Union, the United States, NATO, even the United Nations to a limited extent, when people band together for this limited end, after a while, it's kind of, as you said earlier, it's the fake it till you make it. At a certain point, there's just too much interrelation, and people kind of forget what the original divisions were.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, we happen to live in an age where technology makes commerce across traditional boundaries a lot easier, which is, you know, accelerating the pace of the interrelationships. Yeah, I mean, the political look, we'll get into the political situation back on Earth a little bit in
right.
the next installment. But he's let's see, one other thing to highlight is Dink's peculiar form of meditation, right?
Like right.
That he's found. You know, I don't know, which is an interesting it's an interesting metaphor, I think, right? To go into zero gravity and float around. Literally, there are no forces acting on you. Though I suppose it's air conditioned zero gravity, so there is like air. There are air vents, you know. And Orson Scott Card does describe like friction with the air slowing you down eventually.
Right. And
yeah.
And if not, of course, to quibble, you know, when you're in orbit, you actually are under the force of gravity. You're just moving very fast, and so you're falling very quickly. And so it feels like you don't have gravity on you, but that's, you know, neither here nor there.
I suppose, yeah, there's no point in the universe, right, where there is no force acting on you.
Right.
It's just a force that you're not not aware of, I suppose.
One thing I think we should hit before we get too long here is Bonzo, because he's obviously a key character. And his relationship with Ender is psychologically important down the road, and so we should probably talk about their interactions in these chapters.
Yep.
And so the character of Bonzo is, I think, best summed up with his reaction to Ender kind of saving him in the battle. The last battle that Ender fights in Salamander Army is Salamander has been thoroughly beaten. They've been completely rolled up by, I think, Leopard Army. And Ender has been ordered by Bonzo not to fire under any circumstance, that he's just not supposed to fire no matter what. And so Ender is sitting in the back of the room when all the salamanders are dead, but Ender can still fire. And the leopards assume that nobody is left, and so Ender pulls out his gun and is able to freeze enough of Leopard Army that they can't win the game. They can't get through the gate with enough players to win the game.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this saves Bonzo, he can't take it, because he simply can't take the idea that he was saved by anything other than his own brilliance. And he tells Ender, "No good soldier ever disobeys."
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of Bonzo summed up in a nutshell, that obedience is the only virtue that matters.
Right. And Ender clearly has different ideas, and, you know, it's clear that the book is on the side of Ender, right?
Right.
With these ideas, that is to say, winning is the, like, achieving an objective, right, is the thing that matters, and not sort of blind obedience to the authority of a superior.
Right. And it also kind of gives a leadership lesson of, don't give orders that are so either rigid or stupid that it will put one of your people in a position where they'll have to make a decision like that, where it's, they either have to follow an order or sacrifice the mission. You need to give your people enough latitude in their orders so that they can make intelligent decisions on their own.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is a legitimately good leadership principle. That's one of the reasons that this book is on, you know, the Marine Corps reading list, is that's a legitimately good leadership. Every standing order you ever see will have something along the lines of, you know, all of this goes out the window if somebody starts shooting at you or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Ender advocates, I guess, a slightly more agile process, right?
That's
that sort of I don't know, is based on objectives rather than based on prescribing specific actions that have to be taken.
But what do you think about, I guess, the character of Bonzo and the way he's set up to interact with Ender?
Well, with Bonzo and Rose, one of the things that I actually, I mean, I, that I sort of notice that about this is the ethnic parody, right? Or stereotyping, right? Like Bonzo, it's referred, his Spanish honor, you know, is referred to. And this is, I think, this places him, I think, in the context of like an old world kind of outmoded historical, historical worldview, right? Like the Spanish, once being a great colonial power and a great military power, and not so much in the future, I suppose it turns out, right? Because this way of thinking, this sort of honor, this honor way of thinking is sort of outmoded. The sort of unwilling, and he has also the mentality. I'm struggling to articulate the thing I want to say. He has the mentality that in order for him to win, everyone else has to lose. Right? He sort of can't share. He can't share not only authority but also glory, and also kind of, I think, a sense of a sense of his own skill and. His own skill and worthiness, right? Like it's a zero sum game for him. There's only so much pie, rather than like, hey, everyone in the army can somehow participate in the victories, you know?
Right. And that also kind of ties into his view of violence. You know, we've talked about Peter who views violence as an end into itself. And we've talked about Ender who sees violence as a means that is only used to pursue worthy ends. And for Bonzo, you don't get the sense, though he is sort of sadistic, you don't get the sense that he likes violence for violence's sake, but rather that honor being the most important value for him, he's willing to inflict violence in service of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that if somebody, you know, took out their glove and challenged Ender to a duel, Ender would just walk away. Because he has no interest, even if that would like shame him, you get the sense that he would have no interest in fighting a battle just to save face.
Yep.
Whereas clearly for Bonzo, that would be a blood insult, and that would require a fight to the death.
Yeah, sure.
And so I think that's Bonzo's view of violence. I don't know if we get enough sense of Rose to really know what motivates him.
Yeah, I don't know. You get the sense because his sort of it's highlighted, his Jewishness is highlighted, and the, right. The sort of stereotypical association of and the kind of pejorative association with of Jewishness with being like crafty, you know, right? Like or you know, I don't know, scheming. Somehow, right? I think that there's like this kind of anti-Semitic undertone to it that is a little uncomfortable for us, but it's clearly something that's operating in the book. And you get the sense that he's operating out of a kind of terror of not living up to, you know, the expectations conferred on him by his heritage, right? Like
right.
That, like he's, you know, and Dink says it. He doesn't know why he's winning battles. He just knows it has something to do with me, and so he leaves me alone to kind of run my shop the way I want to. That Rose, right, doesn't really is kind of scrambling. A lot of the time, to come up with something, or to not let people down, right?
Right. And Rose is interesting because he's almost the most juvenile of any of the characters. That he kind of behaves how we would expect teenagers to behave in a school where they fight, you know, mock battles in space and have nothing to do all day but shoot each other with laser guns. He screws around and has the dirty little program on his laptop and. You know, he talks trash, but he's not really being mean about it. He's kind of bro-ish in certain points of the book.
Yeah. There's, I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting. Maybe we should leave this to the commenters in the forums, the forum participants. Speaking of being bro-ish and speaking of nudity on the thing, on the little iPad, it's an interesting, thing. It's an interesting detail to focus on, that they're all walking around naked most of the time. Right. And like, does comport with my experience of, you know, of dormitories and like, you know, locker rooms and summer camp and stuff like this. But it's a co-ed environment, though there are many fewer girls, but it's a co-ed environment, and like, and they are sort of latency through, you know, pubescent, almost adult, children. It strikes me as an odd thing to highlight that they're all walking around naked. You know, that Petra's not wearing any clothes. And you know, it strikes me as like part of the utopian vision that like at some point in the future, and there was, you know, the co-ed shower scene, in Starship Troopers is another example of this, though actually, I mean, the purported motive of the co-ed shower scene to show us a sort of utopian future in which, everyone's just over it and we can all shower together is actually ulterior to the, there is an ulterior motive, which is to put some boobs on screen.
Right. Got to fill the seats.
Sure. Right. But like, I dispute the idea that we will ever, and in fact, I dispute the idea that it would be desirable for us to ever, to all shower together, you know? Right.
Like, well, I don't, as you know. Said, we should probably leave this for the comments, but yeah, I'll just throw out the opposing view, because I've never really read those scenes that way. I see it more as being restricted to the fact that they are children.
Sure.
It's unimportant. The nudity is much less important for children than it is for adults, because so I never really read it in that light.
I'll just point out that Battle School runs through puberty, right?
True.
To the point where nudity becomes very important.
Right. And there's actually an interesting bit where Bonzo cares about who skins, I think is the term, near Petra, but Ender doesn't. Because of course, that might be a function of,
right, because Ender is prepubescent, and so is Petra, and Bonzo sort of has a different set of stakes in mind with respect to nudity. Though you think this is another thing where you think that, you know, adult supervision, right, is sort of is sort of required,
needed. Right?
Okay, well, I guess we will leave our discussion there and leave it to you in the comments. Sorry, not comments, in the forums, because we're not using the normal overthinking of comments on for these podcasts. We are putting it over to the forums, where I remind you, you can start your own discussion topics in addition to jumping in to the ones that we set out for you. Don't just drink what the giant pours, you know. Go up and hit the attack button in the comments, though our comments are always very civil and respectful, and we appreciate that. So we'll be back with week 3 of Ender's Game next week. Until then, you can visit us on the web at Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve.